Is open. Let me explain a little bit what we're going to do today. We are, I am going to start, and don't be alarmed by this, anybody. I'm going to start with a work session. The work session is simply going to be to adopt the LC draft of the bill that we just received not long ago today. And we will move that into the bill just so that we have a vehicle to work from in the next couple meetings. And then I will immediately move to a public hearing after we take that amendment. As you know, we've had two bills that have been scheduled the whole way here, 373 and 838. 838 is going to be the vehicle that we move this into, just for your own purposes and recognizing the numbers from here on out. 838 will be the bill for the Oregon Renewable Energy Act. With that, I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 838. Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move dash two amendments to Senate Bill 838.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson moves the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 838. Committee, is there any discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? And seeing none, so ordered, the dash two amendments are adopted. I know that there are plenty of folks that will be interested in at least discussing or submitting other amendments. Those we will take up next Tuesday. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 838, and I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 838, and we will start with Ralph Groner.
Mr. Chair, while Mr. Groner comes up, does that mean that for all intent purposes, whatever information testimony we took under SB 373 will apply to 838?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. And anybody who signed up on the sheet that said 373, all of that will apply to 838. And I'm sure there will be mistakes made in the next week with things being submitted under 373. The committee will just consider anything that is presented with respect to the Oregon Renewable Energy Act to be applicable to 838. Mr. Groner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I work for AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and I'd like to compliment you, Mr. Chair, on how your vice chair handled the last meeting, because it was packed and he was very, very courteous to every citizen here, and he did a great job.
Well, that's nice to hear. I also understood he held everybody to a two-minute limit, Mr. Groner, so...
All right. You got a minute and 30 seconds.
You're 30 seconds in already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try to, because I do care about people having the opportunity, I'll talk rapidly. I won't read my statement. That's not something I need to do since I gave it to you. And secondly, my testimony will be a bit different. Of course, AFSCME and particularly my locals such as DEQ, Metro, all of those are locals of AFSCME. They asked me to testify in front of you in support of renewable energy standards, but I look back, and I'll say this as rapidly as I can. We also are involved in the clean diesel, the clean air initiative, the bottle bill significantly, and I looked at this and I said, hold. I sat back from the committee and realized that we ought to give it a name, and I gave it a terrible name, the Oregon Independence Plan, which basically says if we were to pass as a committee in Oregon this session, the bottle bill, a good bottle bill, if we, you already have looked at biofuels, if we do biofuels, if we have a renewable energy standard, if we have all of the clean air initiative, all of those things that if you were to take those as a package, I think you've hit a big issue with Oregonians. Quite frankly, they'd be proud, because what I've been told by the department heads, if that were to happen in totality, we would be a national leader. And that is something I happen to think Oregonians are looking to reclaim. And therefore, I'm very proud of the work this committee is doing, because you're doing a monumental task if you view all of these collectively. Why? And I'll close with this thought. If you call it something different than the Oregon Independence Plan, what you have with all of those measures collectively you've heard and will hear, a declaration of independence from dependence on foreign oil, a declaration of independence from global warming, a declaration of independence from higher air pollution and therefore reducing the health care costs that come concurrent with air pollution, such as cancer, health, heart issues, and asthma, which is significantly on the rise in this state. And lastly, independence to create our own jobs in this state that are family wage jobs that provide good, clean, environmental jobs for our people. I sound more like a cheerleader. I think it's absolutely phenomenal the work this committee's doing. Please look at all of your measures collectively. Please speak to those Oregonians and legislators as a whole, because if you accomplish this, if I were the coach, you will end up being a national leader in the total areas that I just mentioned independence from. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groner. Armin Minthorn. Mr. Minthorn, you've come some way to get here. Appreciate you taking the time to spend with us.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Armin Minthorn. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on this important bill. Confederated Tribes of Umatilla support the establishment of a renewable portfolio standard for the state's utilities. The Columbia River Treaty Tribes, the Yakima, Nez Perce, Warm Springs, and Umatilla, as apparent tribes to the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, have advocated for the diversification of the Northwest power system in order to take pressure off the hydro system and the resulting adverse effects on salmon, which have devastated tribal fishing economies. Having said this, attached to our written comments is a summary of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission Tribal Energy Vision. More specifically regarding SB 838, we encourage the Senate to stay with the goal of 25% by 2025. We support most of the details of the February 28, 2007 draft bill. As an Indian tribe located in rural northeastern Oregon, we share our neighbors' desire to provide valuable new sources of income for farmers. This helps take the pressure off of farmers to engage in marginal farming practices. Such practices damage water and air quality, impacting salmon, a natural resource and treaty reserved resource essential to my culture, my health, and my way of life. Also, we share the concerns of rural counties that have seen their tax bases dwindling over the years, reducing services to all of us. Renewable energy projects, especially wind and biomass, help increase tax revenues in our struggling rural areas. These same projects increase jobs and help keep money in our communities. On a regional basis, renewable energy standards will help decrease air pollution. As we all know, air pollution poses an increasing health risk to all of us and impacts salmon, which, as stated earlier, are key to our religion, our culture, and our health. On a statewide basis, we share the same concerns as consumers and businesses that rely on stable, predictable power prices. These new standards will help create the stability and predictability. We, in addition, have three concerns. First, encouraging more renewable generation within Oregon and the region is a great vision and goal, but we encourage the Senate to recognize that utilities will need help in developing new transmission as well. The lack of transmission to the west has hindered the development of renewables in eastern Oregon. We will need both the federal and the state government to help in overcoming the economic obstacles if we are to have transmission capacity when we need it, not several years too late. Second, we object to hydropower being considered a renewable resource unless there is adequate fish protection. We have decades of evidence to show the impact of hydropower on salmon. We ask the Senate to add language barring hydro projects from eligibility under the renewable energy standards unless they can show no net detriment to fish. Again, the importance of fish to my health and my culture cannot be overstated. Third, we encourage you to build in tax credits or similar incentives for utilities. The capital-intensive nature of wind projects and their intermittent power production results in a higher cost than fossil fuel projects, pushing utilities to drag their feet on development of renewables. Tax incentives such as credits against property and or income taxes would greatly help. Many generations ago, when my ancestors signed my treaty in 1855, my ancestors had a foresight to take care of generations that followed them. They had a foresight to protect what's important to our lifestyle. Today, all of us are dependent on the same resources. All of us are dependent on clean water and clean air. What I don't want to do, senators, is hold up a picture of a salmon to my great-grandchildren. I do not want to do that. You are dependent on the same resources I am. Your future generations are dependent on clean resources just as mine. Senators, you make policy just as I do at home. Our policies have to have a foresight to plan for future generations. Clean water is essential. None of us can live without water. None of us can live without clean air. The state of Oregon needs to recognize and plan to have clean resources. The tribes will help you do that. But most important, the future generations that are still coming yet, I hope in some way they'll have a memory of Senator Prusansky, Senator Avakian, Senator Atkinson, Senator Bates, that they'll talk about us in a good way and what we did for them. My ancestors, 10,000 years ago to today, we have taken care of our resources, because those resources have sustained us since this world was created. There isn't any reason that we and the tribes and the state can do the same. Our environment is paying right now. We need to protect our environment. We need to protect it for future generations. That's your responsibility. As senators, that's my responsibility as a policy person with my tribe. And there isn't any reason, Senator Beyer, that we can't do that together. So I express these words to you today, and I expect in some manner that you can walk your talk and you can take the same responsibility as a senator and as a state. We can't lose our environment. He supports all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minthorn. This is the second time Mr. Minthorn has come down to testify before us, but I appreciate you very much making the trip again. Mr. Donovan, did you have anything to add?
Only to identify myself for the record, Phil Donovan, Government Affairs Representative for the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and just to reference that the materials that Armin Minthorn referred to were distributed to the committee when we met in subcommittee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you, for being here. So that folks know, I'm going to start bringing people up in panels. I'm taking the folks who have been here on multiple occasions because we ran out of time, couldn't get to them, or that are more than 100 miles away, and then we will get to the folks that were signed up today. So next, Barbara Byrd, Jefferson Smith, and Fred Hempty. Byrd, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Vaki and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Byrd. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO supports Senate Bill 838, the Renewable Energy Act. We believe it represents a win-win for Oregonians, providing the means to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, to clean up our environment and stimulate our economy. You've heard a lot of testimony that I'm not going to rehash about the impact of SB 838 on energy independence and protecting public health and the environment, access to stable and affordable power. We believe all those things are true. I do want to briefly emphasize the contribution that the bill can make to developing Oregon's economy and creating jobs, which is really what attracts us to this legislation. Estimates vary, but it's clear that this bill will bring billions of dollars of new economic activity to the state and region. Wind energy alone can create several thousand new jobs in Oregon. We believe that the economic potential of the solar industry as well may be even greater, and especially over the longer term as the cost of solar energy approach those of carbon-based sources. We're especially supportive, because of this interest in jobs, of the features of SB 838 that would limit the geographical eligibility of renewable energy resources and promote community-based renewable energy projects. These two aspects of 838 are crucial. The extent to which we promote local development will determine the extent to which we're able to create jobs, and so we think that provision of the bill really needs to remain as it is. We also believe, though, that the future of renewable energy in this state will partially be determined by the extent to which it employs a highly trained, highly qualified workforce. One of our affiliate union leaders is here today, Dan Campbell from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and I hope he'll have time to testify about the training that the IBEW does for workers in the solar industry. They are able to develop a workforce that has the qualifications that are needed to make the solar industry one that we can be proud of. And the expansion of those kinds of training programs will be crucial as the RES rolls out in the state. We'll be working with our environmental, community, and business allies to make sure that the jobs that are created in renewable energy pay a family wage and benefits as well, that they provide access to registered apprenticeship and other sources of training, and offer Oregon's workers not dead-end jobs, but job stability and career ladders. The job impact study provision of 838 will enable us to measure our progress in this area after a couple of years after the bill is passed, and we're looking forward to working with the Department of Energy and others on implementing this provision. So as I'll wrap up, just to say that we want to make sure that the economic benefits of this bill, of which we feel there will be many, are spread equally among the citizens of Oregon, equally and fairly. We believe that if the economic benefits of the bill are recognized by the citizens of Oregon, then the public support for this legislation will also be strengthened. So we want to help with that education job as well. So thank you for allowing us to speak about the bill.
Jefferson Smith with the Oregon Bus Project.
I want to say three things briefly. First, to say something briefly about the importance of the bill. Second, to talk about four experiences that we've had in seeing the breadth and depth of the support for renewable energy standard. And third is to urge vision and to applaud the leadership of the committee and the legislature on the matter. First, with regard to the importance, we work a lot with young people who are concerned about the future of the state. They're, yes, concerned about the environment. They're also concerned about the future economic stability of this state. And when we look at potential opportunities over the next 10 to 20 years, there's a chance that renewable energy and new energy could be a new kind of dot-com boom to the economy. But instead of being a suburb to Silicon Valley, we could be a center of energy excellence. All right, that's the first thing. Second is a set of experiences that we've had to see the level of support for this issue. First was about over the last 6 months, had a chance to participate in community forums around the state. 1,200 people in from Hood River, Corvallis, Bend, Klamath Falls, LeGrand, Portland. And among the most important concerns that they shared was concern about energy independence, their concern about global climate change. Second, the one of the most important hopes that they had was the chance for a renewable energy economy. Second experience was asking about 30,000 online members what they thought mattered in the state, what they wanted to advocate for. And tied only with healthcare and education, rural energy was among the top issues. Third experience was a forum that we had. About 350 people came for a long weekend and talked about a set of ballot initiatives, a set of issues that they could advocate for. And number one with a bullet was a plan for renewable energy. There was nothing that seemed to be more important. The last was an interesting one, and I spend my time, my family's from Umatilla County. I came today from Roseburg, but I live in Portland, and I hang out with a lot of liberal folks. But I had a chance to spend, that's true, but I had a chance to be a lunch keynote at the Farm Bureau in Newport this past year. And talking to rural farmers, the opportunity to use their land for wind turbines rather than just have to sell it to developers, the chance for biofuels was a huge economic opportunity that they recognized. So some of that was energy, and particularly the conference, that was energy that wanted to lead to a ballot initiative, which is why I wanted to thank this committee and thank the legislature, because this is an opportunity for us to get it right. This is the body where it should happen. This is the reason the process exists. I want to applaud the committee chair and the panel and the legislature for doing it, because time is probably almost up. Let me merely say, as the last piece, that the that what we are hoping is that this is not the kind of the only thing we do for renewable energy, but instead that we use this as a first step and create Oregon as a place that leads the nation in the matter. This is a chance to demonstrate leadership, and I thank you guys for taking a step on that leadership today.
Chair Avakian and members of the committee, my name is Fred Hewitt. I'm the Oregon Sierra Club Energy Coordinator, and I'm also the chair of the Global Warming and Energy Committee of the National Sierra Club, which has 800,000 members, and this is our top priority now. We have a project called Sustainable Energy Solutions, and this bill is a sustainable energy solution. I'm going to make four brief points that summarize my testimony. First is to recognize the important step that we're taking today is really the most important bill for renewable energy that, in my personal opinion, we have seen since the 1981 session, when Governor Attia presented a package of bills that were based on the work of the Alternate Energy Development Commission, work that I think we should go back and look at again to see how far we've come. That package set the stage for the research and the work that's been done over the last 26 years to bring us to this moment. And I think that we're now really ready to move in the direction that the vision that we had that far ago, we're now ready to make that happen. The second thing is to recognize the importance that this has to the entire state. This is a theme that's come up over and over again in the testimony, and this has been true all along. We knew that if we were to invest in the renewable energy potential of this state, it would combine the financial resources and the energy needs of the urban areas with the ability and the capability of the rural areas to develop and provide the energy that we need. It's a much more balanced approach to economic development. The third point is to note that
There is one area that probably we should be thinking about a little bit in a little bit broader way. We support and thank you for the amendment in Dash 2 amendments that refers to woody biomass. The question that this raises is a broader one, however. The biomass and biofuels area is a lot of potential in the state, but there are many different types of materials, many different types of processes. And we think that in order to make the best investment in those that provides stability and regulatory certainty to the industries that are going to develop those materials and to consumers and to our environment, we'll need some kind of screening approach to ensure that good resources are developed. And Sierra Club, not surprisingly, is concerned about too much taking of products, lumber, or not lumber, standing timber out of old growth areas, for example. We're concerned about the use of corn from other states to provide corn ethanol in this state after it's already got a great deal of tax credits and other support elsewhere. These are issues that cannot be solved in a simple way. We are, in my view, going to need some kind of process to help sort out those biofuels and biomass projects that are of high quality and deserving of our tax credits and deserving of being in the renewable energy standard. Now, we can't probably solve all that in this bill, but I flag that as an important step that I think we should be thinking about. And thank you very much for the work on the bill, and we support Senate Bill 838.
Very good. Thank you very much, you three, for coming today. Chair Beyer, are you in the room? There you are. Why don't you come on up? I saw you signed up here but didn't see you in the room sitting, or we would have had you up right away because I think you have a press schedule today. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I was hoping to let some others come first and answer any tough questions you might have. But given that, here we are. Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Commission, I want to put the Commission on record as being in support of the Governor's RPS plan. We've looked at it. We think that it's the right direction for Oregon. It's a high goal, but I think it's an achievable goal over time, and I think it's the right thing for us to be doing as citizens of this state. It is consistent, frankly, with the direction that the utilities that we regulate currently, which include the three large IOUs, Idaho Power, PGE, and Pacific Power, were going. I think I mentioned that the last time I was here talking about Senate Bill 87, talked about some of the things we're doing there. Pacific is already on target to bring in, under our last merger case, 1,400 megawatts of renewable power. PGE is on target to... currently, there are about 225 and are moving fast in that direction. So we think, as I was saying, we think that these are doable targets, although I want to be honest and say they're stretch targets, but I think that's okay. I think it's moving in the right direction. I know there have been some concerns about cost, and certainly that's an issue. A point that I would make to you about cost as you hear these discussions is that any new energy source that we bring into the portfolio of the utilities is going to cost more than it does today and what we have in rates today. So it's important, as I pointed out before, and I'm beating on the drum again, what's important overall as we think about these things and meeting our energy demands is that we look both towards conservation or energy efficiency, which is the cheapest way. The cheapest power available is the power you don't have to buy. And we've made good progress in doing that in the last few years, and I think you're going to be considering more of that as you go forward to this bill. But beyond that, all the new sources are going to be expensive, more expensive, and I think the renewables that are there are within those cost parameters. I know that people are concerned about cost. One of the things that we've looked at is the cost cap that's setting there. We believe that you really have two triggers as the legislature to have control about that. One is the cost cap that's in the bill, the 4% cost cap, that I think is a realistic trigger. It's an off-ramp in case things get out of hand, some people's concerns. And frankly, the other one you have is if the strategy isn't working, the legislature meets every year. And I've always thought about the statutes as evolutionary, and I think the legislature is very good at containing things. Another concern that I've heard people express is that the plan that's laid out here may not be consistent with the Commission's longstanding integrated resource planning process, which is our way of looking ahead of trying to contain costs and making sure the customers are not paying more than they should. for power. The plan that's in here in terms of bringing renewables on actually dovetails rather nicely, I think, with our standard IRP process, and we sort of expect for the utilities we regulate that they'll go hand in glove, and we'll be looking at that on it. We usually, utilities usually bring that in every other year, so I think it works well that way. So, Mr. Chair, the last piece I guess I would say is that I know that there have been a lot of advocates and different agendas about how to do all of this. As is normal in this process, different people get together to craft a compromise. From the Commission's perspective, as we've looked at it, what was important to us, since if the legislature chooses to adopt this strategy, about 70% of the impact will fall upon the Commission to implement. We've looked very strongly at it and worked with utilities and other interested parties over the last couple of weeks to make sure that the document, as in the amendments you see today, are things that we can implement, and we feel comfortable that as we know them today, and I have to say that they just came out, so you know, I'm assuming that what's in your amendments is what we had worked on the last couple of weeks. Our staff is workable. So
that's right.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll conclude my comment, and we look forward to working with the legislature and other people if you choose to move down this direction to make sure this is a success for Oregon.
Very good. Chair Beyer, thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Beyer, you mentioned the cost cap, and I just want to clarify the difference between the cost cap and a rate cap.
Uh-huh.
And if this is a rate cap in the bill or in the amendment.
Senator, based on our conversations this morning, I thought you might ask that question. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, as we've looked at it, and you know, I don't want to go into great detail on it, but I guess I can bring up Dr. Sparling if you want to dwell on this. But we looked at it, and a rate cap and the cap that's in the bill, is on revenue requirement. Effectively, it's the same thing. It's about 4%. It's an apples to apples, although I will caution you that what you're looking at, the rate cap applies to the energy portion of a rate, not the other things such as pension funds and that. So when we're doing the annual comparison, we will compare what would a new fossil fuel cost compared to what is the cost that's proposed by the utility to meet the renewable target. And so we're just looking at that energy slice of that bill, and if that would go up more than 4%, would have an off-ramp, as I understand the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Bill Cluding, Sandy Lonsdale, Jeremy Hayes. After this panel, we will have gone through most of the folks that have either been here before and had to wait because we didn't get to them, or that came from more than 100 miles away. And I've given a little more latitude to those folks that have been here before. After these, try and keep your testimony to about 2 minutes so that we can make sure we get through, with the exception of a couple panels. I know the rural co-ops have got a presentation to make and such. Keep to about 2 minutes so we can make sure we get through everybody. Mr. Cluding.
Thank you, Chair. Walk in the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Since 1957, of our worst fire years have happened in the last 11 years. The record was broken in 2005, and the record was broke again in 2006. 2006 burned 10 million forested acres, costing dozens of lives, thousands of homes. The firefighting cost alone was $2.4 billion, and the costs are still coming in. These fires in 2006 destroyed 40 billion board feet of timber. The economic value of $24 billion. In front of you is a page that has a map of Oregon on it. And let's just talk about the 4.5 million acres that we have already logged once or twice in our national forest in our time. You'll see the hexagons is 160,000 acres, each hexagon. The darker the green, the more woody biomass is on the ground. The darkest green is 1 million tons per 160,000 acres. You have a sheet also I handed out, shows what happens when wood burns. The chosen wood stove, open burn, 140 pounds of carbon monoxide, 17 pounds of particulates goes into the air for one ton of wood being burnt. On the far right of this sheet is a biomass cogeneration plant in the southern part of our state that's been there since 1985. This is the DEQ readings from that biomass plant. You can see it's almost zero. All this stuff going in the air is creating global warming. These high levels of biomass create catastrophic fires we have today. These fires create their own wind. The hotter the fire, the higher the wind, to where man can't stop it. Sometimes we have to rely on nature to help us. Chair Bakken, committee, we can carefully extract a large share of this biomass, creating a healthier forest, creating jobs, and renewable energy. Our biomass cogeneration plants, and we're this close to our ethanol plants, this close for technology. We can get away from fossil fuels. And one quick note, I want to thank you for signing on to House Joint Memorial 12. It urges Congress to allow 15-year contracts for biomass removal. And this is what these plants are going to need to sufficiently get the bank loans to create these jobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clitting.
Chair and members, I'm Sandy Lonsdale. I'm here today to give you some broad comments about the RPS and some specific comments about the biomass provisions. I live in Bend. I was here on Tuesday. I had to watch from outside the room there, but I did watch. I'm very interested in this. I've supported renewable energy through my work and through my volunteer work for the last 15 years. Up until mid-January, I worked for a company in Bend called Vulcan Power Company. We're a small renewable energy developer. We develop geothermal and biomass energy, what are called baseload energy. They compete directly with the fossil fuels in terms of output and capacity. They can certainly compete directly if all the subsidies for oil and gas were removed. Geothermal and biomass would actually be more affordable. And to some degree, they're both... Well, biomass is not sustainable, I don't believe, but geothermal certainly is, if it's done right. I've also worked for the last 6 years for a group in Central Oregon called CoPower. It's the Central Oregon Partnership for Wildfire Risk Reduction. It's a group, it's an effort done by the Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council. It's a great group in Central Oregon. I've since learned that there are similar groups around the state. Direct your attention to one called the Willamette Partnership. It may have some consensus building, some sort of stakeholder collaboration stuff that you might want to look at, since the bill you are now working on is a critical bill for Oregon. And it's got to be done right, and certainly passing a bad bill would be worse than passing no bill at all, in my opinion. Our company worked for 3 years on the California RPS bill. It's a good example. It passed fairly unanimously at the end. There was a whole bunch of war that went on. The utilities in California are slightly different than the utilities in Oregon. The utilities in California had been beat up a bit with bankruptcies and blackouts. We haven't had those in Oregon yet. Hopefully we won't. But the California utilities, the IOU utilities, screamed about the RPS bill, saying it was going to raise rates and that we couldn't do it. And yet the Assembly finally did pass a bill, and it's a good bill, and it's a good bill for an example for Oregon. The implementation language, of course, is critical, too. Specifically about biomass, and we're going to get comments to you, by the way, in the next few days before your next work session. The project that I worked the hardest on the last 3 years was a project in Lapine called the Lapine Biomass Project. It was we have a contract for that energy. It's a 10-year contract with Pacific Gas and Electric, a San Francisco-based utility. That project began as perhaps a 20-megawatt standalone power plant fueled by forest thinning. My background is forest conservation work as a volunteer for the Sierra Club and ONRC, now Oregon Wild. I now feel that that project was oversized because I've worked with the Forest Biomass Working Group for the last year and a half. I fear that the timber industry is going to use this biomass provision that I hear has been amended, and maybe the amendment will make it better. But to hear that Roseburg Lumber is in the biomass business now scares me, because they're one of the companies that's done most a lot of the damage to Northwest Forest that's created some of this fire problem. If we're going to let them go and
I'll
fix
need,
the
I'll need you two within about a minute to go ahead and finish up your point.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you. Biomass needs some sort of additional review, some scientific review, biomass projects. It could be done through a group called, like COIC in Central Oregon, other sorts of groups that already have boards that are big consensus building, large stakeholder groups. It needs that sort of oversight. Otherwise, I believe biomass will become what they're calling the next gold mine from the forest. And it'll create more problems in the forest than it'll actually solve. We do have a big fire problem. I've lived in Central Oregon since 1972. We need to do something about that problem, but we need to be very careful. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jeremy Hayes. I'm pleased to be here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Apollo Alliance in favor of SB 838. As you've probably noticed, the introduction of this legislation has generated interest from a number of diverse constituencies. The Oregon Apollo Alliance is a new coalition of labor unions, environmental organizations, businesses, and social justice groups that are dedicated to the idea that we can create energy independence and clean energy and thousands of good-paying jobs for Oregon's residents. Senate Bill 838 is one of a package of clean energy bills that our coalition is supporting during this legislative session, and we're pledged to support it by educating the public about its multiple benefits. Now, I think you all have heard from many of our partners and the organizations that are part of our coalition on the benefits of this bill: good jobs, business opportunities, a cleaner environment. We're particularly pleased that this renewable energy standard will support market forces that not only create good jobs, but also stimulate workforce training programs that can bring a whole new generation of low-income Oregonians into family-supporting career paths. And I think you've already heard, or you will hear, from opponents of this legislation that are concerned about the costs associated with the renewable energy standard. And we see that a little bit differently. The Apollo Alliance takes its name from the Apollo Moon program of President Kennedy in the 1960s that forwarded a vision for America of, within a decade, implementing a crash program to put a man on the moon and the benefits that would come from that. And our partners from the different constituencies believe that what America needs now is a crash program for energy independence that will create numerous good jobs. And we see any cost associated with the renewable energy standard as a down payment on that vision. And the returns are numerous: cleaner air, better jobs, more business opportunities, a renewed manufacturing base in the state. And it positions Oregon as a leader in the country on these issues. So I want to thank you for your leadership, and thank you for moving this legislation.
Well, thank you, all three of you, for being here. We appreciate your testimony very much. Doris Penwell and Andrea Fogue. And after these two, just so that you're aware, Sandy Flicker, I know you've got a panel of consumer owns. You'll go next. And then after that, Julie Brandeis with the AOI and ICNU panel will be after that.
Welcome. Chair. Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and I won't take much of your time because I know some of our leadership from AOC will be here next week. But I wanted to at least be able to let you know that the Association of Oregon Counties has decided to support the RPS bill, along with a number of renewable energy proposals that have come forth this legislative session. And we're interested in this for the most part because it will help develop a renewable industry, renewable energy industry in Oregon. And we see the RPS as much important as the incentive bills that are coming through the legislature, and in addition, some of the funding proposals and current research that's being done in renewable energy. So all of those things really need to go together, and we think the RPS makes it a much better package by having that there. As you know, we have a lot of renewable energy projects that are developing around Oregon now, and it's helping some of those communities already. It will begin to in the next few years, both in terms of the local economy, but also to help the tax bases in those communities. And they really badly need them now. As you know, the counties and their communities are suffering some serious losses from the prospect of losing federal monies, and either in the short term or the long term, we have to plan for ourselves and do something else other than just sit back and wait, you know, for the next thing to happen. And we really do see that developing a renewable energy industry in Oregon is the thing we must do, and for once, it is an industry that might help the rural parts of the state as much or more than it will help the urban parts of the state. And that's why you're seeing these people from communities and from counties coming in and testifying in strong support of this bill. And the real reason that I think most people in the county structure are supporting it is because we see that it will help keep the energy to be used in Oregon rather than developing a project and selling the energy to some other state that has an RPS. So we might as well do it an Oregon way instead of following somebody else's lead in these categories. And I know, finally, we want to say, because, you know, there are 36 counties and 118 county commissioners, and they all have their own opinions about all these things. They're not all in lockstep, as I know you know. We assume that as this bill moves through the legislature that some of the kind of very complex issues that are before you will be well thought out, and that we will somehow reach a conclusion that will at least partly satisfy the most of us. So thanks a lot for considering all of these things.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities. You'll see that the testimony that I provided to you is actually on behalf of Scott Winkles, who is the lead on our energy policy, but he was unable to be here today, so I'm just going to go over the highlights with you. So the League is here in support of Senate Bill 838 and a renewable power standard, or energy standard, interchangeably, I think, is as we're calling it. And I just want to talk with you a little bit about the city's perspective, both as a very significant consumer, large consumer group, as well as the protection of the interests of our citizens. And so, as you'll see in the testimony, there are really three criteria that we laid out as we were looking at the prospect of an RPS in Oregon. The first of that really was ensuring that the RPS is a positive market influence. We know that we more and more are relying on imported sources of energy. We're facing a volatile energy market as we look at the future, and we're really looking for mechanisms to stabilize that market. And we think the RPS is one that can really help us get there in terms of both diversity with renewable energy resources and self-reliance, which is very important as we look at the future. The second of those criteria, cost protections. And really, again, that's from the perspective as a consumer and also from the protection of our citizens as ratepayers. And we know that we want to protect against really spikes, increases in prices. And the cost cap really addresses that for us and was important as we looked at this proposal. And then the third of those criteria really being local control and flexibility. And as we looked at this, the alternative compliance payment, the ACP, was really key here for us. Again, not only important to us as consumers, but also for our cities that are utilities as well, because we think that this helps us work toward the goal and investing in renewable resources, but it's not a one-size-fits-all, and that's very important, again, to that flexibility. So in closing, I'd just like to say that really the state of Oregon has been an innovator when it comes to energy policy, and cities were right there alongside you. It was really the first city in the nation was in Oregon that was successfully a green building certified by the national standard. We've also got cities looking at putting solar panels on all of their government buildings, and the league is working to bring the very first biosolids to energy plant here to Oregon. It would be the first in the nation. And so as we move forward, we really look forward to being partners and continuing to allow Oregon to be an innovator in energy policy. And we think that the RPS really is a step in that direction. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Sandy, would you like to bring your panel up?
Mr. Chair, as they're coming up, I needed to ask you, Mr. John Prescott is here from PNGC Power, which is a cooperative. He has a transmission presentation, and I didn't know whether you wanted him to come up with us now or whether you wanted to call him up afterwards.
You know, why don't you just do it afterwards? Let's get the four of you done. Mr. Goddard found a seat, and then we'll catch up with him, okay?
Okay, thank you. We only have brief comments. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. With me today is Mr. Mark Farmer, who's a general manager of West Oregon Electric Cooperative in Vernonia, Mr. Don Goddard, who is the executive director of the Oregon People's Utility Districts Association, and Mr. Paul Davies, who's the general manager of Central Lincoln PUD. I will start making some brief comments and then ask Mr. Farmer to share a small utility perspective, our small utility perspective, and then Mr. Goddard and Mr. Davies. As we've testified in the past with interim committees and committees during this legislative session, rural electric cooperatives use renewable resources, invest in renewable resources, and invest in renewable resource technology. Senate Bill 838 is not about our use of or investment in renewables. Co-op's own Coffin Butte, which is a landfill gas renewable project, co-op's just announced a big investment in wave technology and will be buying the output of wave energy. Co-op's on the east side are working with wind developers to provide transmission for wind projects and to buy some of the output of wind projects. These resource decisions have all been made by locally elected boards of directors whose mission is to provide least cost reliable power to the consumer owners using energy that does not contribute to global warming. They use over 70% hydropower as customers of the Bonneville Power Administration. Co-op boards are entrusted with determining the rates for their small utility customers. They take this responsibility very seriously, as you as elected officials take your responsibility to represent your constituents. They are very cognizant of the fact that all of the rates of the utilities affect all of their customers and directly affect their customers because we're cost-based utilities. They, like you, have an obligation to make good decisions that will bring benefits to their rural communities. When their governing authority is taken away from them, this causes concern, as it would for any elected official. For co-ops, Senate Bill 838 does that. These bills, with the amendments we have seen, take away the authority of a number of locally elected boards to manage their utilities' power supply. If the goal of a renewable portfolio standard is reducing global warming and decreasing dependence on oil, then fortunately you have a group of 36 consumer-owned utilities in Oregon that rely almost entirely on resources that don't contribute to global warming and don't depend on oil to keep the lights on. I wanted to quickly show you the chart, my famous chart.
you see this little tiny box down here. This is the consumer-owned utilities contribution to emissions in the state. Tiny little box. If the goal of an RPS is to stimulate economic development, we are very fortunate that 36 utilities in Oregon have made every effort to control the cost of electricity to their consumers so that business and industry is able to stay in their service territories and are not driven out by higher electricity rates, and they're also able with those electricity rates to possibly attract new business. We are fortunate that we have wind development in co-op service territories east of the mountains that has created new income to counties and new jobs in these sparsely populated areas of Oregon. We are fortunate that every effort has been made by these utilities to create a sustainable environment for their communities. We have major concerns about the future of our electricity supply, which accounts for about 65% of our costs. We will be renegotiating our contracts with BPA in 2011, but don't yet know what the cost of that power is going to be, nor the amount of that power that we're going to be able to purchase. We know the additional power we need beyond BPA is going to be more expensive than hydropower. We have concerns about the increased cost of transmission and the increased cost to acquire firm power to back up non-firm wind power. All of these issues and concerns are on the plates of the boards of directors of my 18 electric co-ops at every monthly board meeting. What co-op boards are asking the legislature for is the ability to continue to manage their not-for-profit utilities with member oversight to provide emission-free, least-cost, reliable power as they do today. Co-ops are just as concerned about the environment, both now and in the future, as anyone who has come before this committee. They believe they can contribute to the goal of a renewable future and the goal of maintaining economically viable small rural communities, given the continued authority to manage their utilities. Increased regulations to small utilities means increased staff and increasing legal budgets to simply comply with regulation, not necessarily to increase the benefit to their members. New regulation only decreases their flexibility to choose their power supply based on environmental goals and the need to maintain affordable power in the rural communities of the state that have the lowest per capita income in the state. The most severely distressed counties in Oregon in 2005 were counties served by electric cooperatives. In closing, we respectfully request your support for an exemption for utilities serving less than 3% of the total electricity load in Oregon. And I wanted to make one quick comment about some testimony yesterday. There was testimony regarding the Texas Renewable Portfolio Standard. And I just wanted to mention that in Texas there are 79 electric cooperatives. Electric cooperatives are exempt from the Texas RPS. We ask you to continue to use emission-free power. We ask you to let the co-ops continue to use emission-free power, continue to invest in other renewable resources, continue to serve the most difficult geographic areas of Oregon with affordable, reliable power by continuing their 60-year tradition of local decision-making. Thank you very much. Mr. Farmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. West Oregon Electric Co-op that I represent is it's a member-owned and operated utility. We basically serve 1,224 square miles of territory that crosses five counties, and we serve over a million trees with 4,300 meters sprinkled among them. And so it's a very small utility. We average about 6.5 meters per mile. For 62 years, we've made our own choice and decisions with the member elected board on how to best serve our power needs and where to get our power supply from. And I think we've done so in a reasonable fashion. All of the power that we purchase now is clean, renewable power. We get it from hydro, we get it from Coffin Butte, and we've invested in the wave technology as Sandy. So we think we've been reasonable stewards to our community and to our state. My concerns about the RPS, the way that it stands is, the way that I read it is that any load growth that we are going to incur, which with Beaverton and Hillsboro headed out our way, it's inevitable that growth is going to happen to us, that I need to purchase that in wind or solar. Problems are, as I'm not sure if you're familiar with Vernonia or not, but the wind doesn't always blow there and the sun doesn't shine very often there, and so those opportunities are not there in Vernonia, and they're not in close proximity to us. So in order to purchase those, I'm going to have to incur increased transmission costs to bring them in from other areas in the state. I'm also going to have to purchase some other form of power in order to back those up, because they're not firm power, because the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. and the waves aren't consistent throughout the year. So I'm going to need another firm power source to back that up. Now, I don't have neither the staff nor the finances to be able to manage multiple sources of energy. I can't afford to do that internally. I would have to pay either hire somebody to do that or pay for someone else to manage that for me. And at West Oregon Electric Co-op, the state average for rates is 7.5 cents per kilowatt hour. We are the highest rates in the state at 10.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So any increase in cost to us directly, directly comes out of my members' pocket. It doesn't come out of profit margins, and it doesn't come out of shareholders. It comes right out of the pockets of my consumers. The other concern that I have is that the cost cap that is included in Section 12 of this bill is based on retail rates. And our neighbors just across the mountain to us are sitting at 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour, and we're at 10.5. Who do you think is going to be penalized more with a cap that's set on retail rates? We're going to be three times, we're going to be three times more penalized than our neighbors to the north. So that places an unfair burden, we think, on West Oregon Electric Co-op. The other thing that concerns me is that power is bought and sold in 1 megawatt increments. In order for me to purchase a 1 megawatt increment to serve 5% of my load growth presents a problem to me when my entire load is only 7 megawatts. What do I do with a whole megawatt when I only need several kilowatt hours of it? That means I'm either going to have someone hire someone else again or staff up to manage the excess and sell that to someone else. My contention is as I mentioned, that for 62 years we have done very, very well. I think we've managed our stewardship in a responsible manner. And the way I see it, we've already been doing exactly what the governor's asked. We have been purchasing and using clean, renewable energy. And I guess in my mind, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Thank you.
Before we move on, I just wanted to make sure that I'm understanding your testimony in context here. You're with West Oregon, right?
Yes.
We have down that you have this numbers from the Oregon Department of Energy that you have 0.15% of the total electrical load of the state. Does that sound about right?
For West Oregon?
Yeah.
Probably.
Okay, and so you understand that even under the current bill, without any amendments, that puts you well under the 1%, which means you're completely exempt from any standards.
Mr. Chair, let me respond to that. That is true. However, the language in the bill that takes the exemption away regarding coal puts them right back into the mandate because they purchase their power through PNGC Power, which is a joint operating agency. And in the new bill draft, if there's any investment in coal through PNGC Power, then all of their members, including West Oregon Electric, lose that exemption. So they would, in essence, then be back into the exemption. Thank you.
We don't actually own any of the coal plant at all, but because we joined with several others to purchase power through that organization, the way the bill reads, we would be penalized as well, even though we don't even own any of it.
Well, possibly, and it's certainly not something. We have so many people to testify, we don't want to get into a debate about it now. I don't think the intent of the bill is to capture folks with such a small load as you for that type of a relationship. But okay, go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Davies. I'm General Manager of Central Lincoln People's Utility District in Newport, Oregon. We serve about 40,000 customers in rural Lincoln, Lane, Douglas, Coos counties. We were energized in 1943. Central Lincoln opposes 838 in its present form. The bill would mandate that Central Lincoln provide specific percentages of energy sales to be from renewable resources by specific target dates. At this point, our board is responsible to the voters for their wholesale power cost and all costs associated with delivering that energy. And wholesale power cost, in fact, accounts for 60% of our operating cost. This would be a significant cost driver of our rates that is dictated by an outside body, by legislative fiat. Central Lincoln is the full requirements customer of Bonneville Power. I'm sorry. Central Lincoln has a full requirements customer of Bonneville Power Administration, which means that greater than 85% of our resources are hydro, and we believe renewable. Central Lincoln is currently involved in a development with four entities exploring ocean power viability on the coast. It's Ocean Power Technology, Ocean Power Delivery, Oregon State University, and Lincoln County. All this effort is to support local economic development for an emerging technology. It would be untenable to purchase output from ocean renewable resources if we're already obligated by state or legislative fiat to other renewable purchases, simply because we had to make such an obligation by a date certain. That would be a great disservice and disincentive to upcoming technologies. In fact, we're working with PNGC and some of the other electric co-ops in the state on that project. Central Lincoln and perhaps other coastal utilities being able to purchase locally developed renewables when viable will mean fewer burdens on an already overly burdened and constrained transmission system. Thank you for your attention.
Mr. Goddard?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Don Goddard, represent six PUDs in the state of Oregon. I'd like to make three quick points. The first is PUDs support renewable resources. The power that our customers use in their homes and businesses is 95% carbon-free and greenhouse gas-free. Might even bring a smile to a senator who has a favorite movie out. The second point I'd like to make is for local control, for PUD, Senator Gore.
Oh. Sorry about Al Gore. A different kind of senator.
You guys didn't get that.
I see these guys on TV, but I haven't seen one.
No.
We're a little slow up here. It's late in the afternoon. Okay. Bear with.
Byer's the only one handsome enough to get his face in a movie, I suppose. I don't know.
I'll try to be quick.
You guys didn't get it, Senator.
For PUDs, what local control means is voters get to decide what resources are used to meet their needs. So the voters in the Dalles have voted for two small hydro projects. The voters in Clatskanie have voted for a cogeneration facility at the Wana Mill. And the voters in Emerald PUD have voted for wind generation. And the voters in the Dalles will consider a proposal for thermal generation for their future needs. And we don't think that a case has been made to preempt these local decisions. The third point that I'd like to make is just to emphasize the magnitude of what you're proposing. In simple terms, what this bill would do would require all of Oregon's energy needs in the future to be met by wind. That's a bit simplistic, but it's not far off. And my point is not to discuss or comment on the wisdom of that idea, but to make the suggestion that the bill needs to include provisions that are commensurate with that challenge so that utilities can be successful. And the kind of things I have in mind are the kind of things that are in the chairman's Senate Bill 812, Senate Bill 820, and comments that I've provided to the chairman's staff and that are in my written testimony. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
All right. Thank you very much. Julie Brandeis, if you don't mind rounding up your ICNU and AOI folks, that would be helpful. And Ms. Flicker, if you could slip me a note on approximately how long Mr. Prescott's slide presentation is, that would be helpful to me in organizing the rest. And for the committee, we're going to go past 4:30. We've got folks that have taken great time and preparation to get here. I want to make sure they get in, so stay as long as you can, please. Mr. Prescott, you're not up quite yet.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get this to blank out.
Sure. Whenever you're ready, go right ahead.
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have the distinct privilege of being the thorn between two beautiful roses, so hopefully I can start off with a little levity this afternoon. And on another more light note, I feel a little bit like a giant wind turbine standing in gale force winds in support of an RPS mandate. So Here it goes. I gave you some handouts that I want to have entered into the record I think are awfully important, and I won't cover those handouts, but they're kind of a pictorial of some of the concerns that we have and some of the issues we hope that you will address as you proceed with the Senate Bill 838. Like everyone else this afternoon and over the course of these hearings, we are committed to doing everything practical to reduce our use of energy, especially those energy sources that emit carbon, and to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we do support cost-effective, diverse renewable energy sources, but not at the expense of ratepayers and not at any price. Overcoming the basic philosophical difference between renewable energy markets driven by normal market investment fundamentals and a forced, artificially created market seems to be the highest hurdle for us from the business community. I've kind of shaped my opening remarks, and I'm going to hand this off to Julie and then to Melinda to back cleanup in things that we support and things that we do not support. And I just say that we do support RPS targets. We think they ought to be cost-effective, renewable, based on cost-effective renewable energy generation. We don't support mandates. We hope that looking at things like removing cost-effective tests and renewable energy acquired at any cost are things that you also wouldn't support. We would support renewable energy resources tied to load growth and generation retirement. We support the full use of and linkage to the integrated planning process. We wouldn't support a pre-approval process for renewable resources separate from the IRP process. We would support including all eligible electric, hydroelectric, and biomass generation. And you've heard some comments about forest biomass on both sides of the spectrum. We think the forest products industry is well positioned to contribute significantly to renewable energy. We wouldn't support the displacement of clean, carbon-free, renewable hydroelectricity. We also do not want to see an exclusion of older renewable energy resources. We would support no age limit on the renewable resources. The 1995 date is arbitrary, and we've had these conversations before in this committee and out in the hallways, and we think there's probably a way to work around that. I'll just give you a classic example. Our Springfield recovery boiler was built before 1995, but we just went through extensive upgrades in 2006. At least the way I understand the bill is written today, and I have not looked at the amendments, that particular facility would not qualify. On the other hand, a very identical facility just down the road, Albany Paper Mill, also has a recovery boiler. It was built in 2000, and it would count. So it seems to me the 1995 date is a bit nonsensical. We think you ought to count all conservation against renewable resource targets. We've heard exhaustive comments in both this committee and other committees about the best bang for our buck is investing in conservation, and we certainly support that, and we heard Commissioner Lee Beyer once again reiterate that. We think that, at least the way I understand the bill is written, there doesn't seem to be much accounting for any or all conservation measures in the bill. We also support true cost caps. We don't think the 4% is going to work. So with that, I would simply turn this over to Julie with AOI and to Melinda the back cleanup.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. I think most of you are very familiar with our organization. It's a very broad-based business organization. And some of the comments I'll be making today will come from a series of meetings that we've been having, both with our board, the AOI Energy Committee, and other group. We've been meeting with proponents, and I think that's important as part of the background. I think you know our members are very supportive of renewable power, and many of our members are voluntary purchasers of renewable and green power. I represented AOI on the Governor's Renewable Energy Work Group and made the following points during the Renewable Energy Work Group's meetings. Our concerns have remained consistent, and we do not believe the bill as we have seen it, and we have not had a chance to look at the amendments, we do not believe that the bill represents
a lot of compromise, at least in respect to our concerns. We, in short, we have about seven concerns: the cost cap, the impact on the IRP, that transmission does matter, the public purpose charge and changes, and those changes must benefit the customers who pay for them. The public purpose charge should be part of the cost cap.
Yeah,
hydro should count, and efficiency should count. Let me start by talking a bit about the cost cap. And I guess I get the honor of being the soothsayer on the Ides of March. But the cost caps, as we've seen it and have reviewed it, is really a Potemkin village. It's a false construct. And this is evidenced by the many inconsistent terms used during these hearings and throughout the legislature to describe the cost cap. During these hearings, during private meetings at AOI, through the media, and discussions with legislators, we continue to hear different descriptions about what this cost cap means. For example, on the first day we heard it was a rate cap. We know now it's not a rate cap. We've heard about the example that I think Commissioner Beyer was discussing today, a differential between green power that we hope to acquire and between the non-renewable power we would have otherwise have bought. We've heard that if the utility hit the cost cap for multiple years, then it would be imprudent, and that would never happen. We've heard that the cost cap is meaningless because we would never hit the cost cap, and it would only trigger under extreme circumstances. So with that being said, you can see why it's hard for AOI members to be convinced that the cost cap is meaningful. There is a way to add meaning to the cost cap, and I think the first thing we need to do is take a look at data to support an interpretation, just as you would in a school distribution formula. We need data to support the 4% to determine whether that is the correct number. We need clearer language to describe what is covered by the cost cap. And then we would need examples submitted into the record. And that is the only way that we as customers can agree on both the definition and whether there is enough certainty to move this work on to the PUC. While on the subject of rates, let me move to our second area of concern. And again, I made these comments throughout the Renewable Energy Work Group. We have been consistent on this issue. The bill says the first $11 million collected from PGE and PacifiCorp customers doesn't count toward the cost cap. Currently, $11 million, or about 19% of the public purpose charge, goes to buy down the above market cost of renewables. AOI agreed to this provision in 1999. In the amendments to Senate Bill 383, these costs do not count toward the cap. This $11 million should, because the originating legislation reads, an electric company that satisfies its obligations under this section shall have no further obligation to invest in conservation, new market transformation, new renewable energy resources, or new low-income weatherization. The legislature is changing the direction of this statute. The money, however, comes from the exact same pocketbook. Let me give you an example. I represent a company that is an employee-owned company, and it has a very small profit margin, and it pays approximately $50,000 a month in public purpose charges. As a portion of that
transmission,
wind power doesn't always blow.
Wind power is only 30%. The company I represent pays approximately $50,000 a month in public purpose charges. A portion of that charge, as I stated, goes to renewables for paying down the above market cost. For that company, it's $9,000 a month. And by the way, if you look at other states, and I'm assuming the Department of Energy submitted this outline that they did of all the other states to you, that it's what they gave the Renewable Energy Work Group. But if you look at the other states, they are all over the map, but in terms of an RPS and in terms of a cost cap. Oregon proposes one of the most aggressive. But take a look at Arizona. They have a cost cap. Their cost cap is $117 a month for loads greater than 3 megawatts. The company I'm talking about is already paying 17 times that amount for renewables. By the way, just as part of that example, PG's share of the ETO, Energy Trust of Oregon's $11 million, is probably $6.6 million. That's just back of the envelope. And we are looking at a PG cost cap, if you look at what 4% of their revenue requirement is, of 9 times that value. So can you understand, based on that example, why it's hard to convince AOI members that this won't have some type of impact? And there is no way I can convince AOI members that the public purpose charge should not count within that cap, at least the renewable portion, not the entire 3%, but at least the renewable portion. And when we made the 1149 deal, we clearly meant that the dollars were going to buy down the above market cost. In fact, the legislation supports our interpretation. It really couldn't be clearer. Our second concern related to the public purpose charge is on the small-scale projects. Under this legislation, the money is being collected from PacifiCorp and PGE customers and primarily going to small-scale projects. Keep in mind, this $11 million goes to the Energy Trust, and the legislature has no oversight. You have placed no parameters on how the trust should make its decision. Is it first come, first serve? If that is the case, since I hear we are a few years off on wave power, does that unfairly harm them? I don't know. Will the trust prioritize projects based on those projects that are most likely to provide both societal and cost benefits to the customers who paid for the investments? Do you know the ETO's current green tag policy? Are you comfortable with that policy? Do you know that policy is not without controversy? The original intent of the public purpose charge was to buy down the cost of any renewable project. If the section is needed to support small-scale resources, fine. Keep in mind the money comes from the same pocket, and it is unfair not to consider it part of the customer's investment. And sure, I'm going to close on not my last point, but I am respectful of the committee's time, and I can put my comments in writing and submit them. But I did want to close on the energy efficiency, and we believe it should count. This legislation is aimed at many things, but it's also aimed at reducing greenhouse gases. Let me use an example from the chairman's district, Siltronic Corporation. Siltronic installed a new heat recovery unit, which now saves 1.9 million kilowatt hours of electricity, 156,000 therms of natural gas, and over 1,300 tons of greenhouse gases per year. These efforts simply don't count in this legislation. What is worse, when we asked about expanding BETI to at least provide the right incentives in light of the RPS, we were told no. Those are our primary concerns. I should also indicate that we think hydro should count. We are concerned about the impacts on the IRP, and that transmission does matter in terms of this legislation. I think you'll hear a good presentation on that later.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Melinda Davison. I'm here on behalf of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. I support the comments of my colleagues, Mr. Miller and Ms. Brandes, and I'm not going to reiterate the points that they have already made very effectively. What I would like to start with is, I think, a somewhat obvious point, but one that I think is important for us to make for the record. ICNU supports cost-effective renewables. We've supported cost-effective renewables for some time now. We also think it's very important for the committee, for the legislature, for the governor, for the state to recognize that the state of Oregon is a leader in green power today. And we think that Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp have done an extremely good job to date of acquiring cost-effective renewables. So, as someone said earlier, we don't think that that system is broken. Are there things that can be done to provide more incentives? Perhaps, but mandates create a whole host of problems that we don't think that the bill adequately addresses. And I'd like to focus on a couple of quick points. The cost caps are something that are extremely important, and you've heard people talk about them in a lot of different ways. But I think that our members compete in a national economy, and the cost caps that are being proposed in this bill will not keep us competitive. If we see those kinds of rate increases, that will be extremely harmful to business in this state. The other thing that we're very concerned about is that if you look at my testimony, the written testimony that I've provided, there is an attachment, and I have provided a chart that shows where the cost cap would be and basically the difference between where that cost cap is and where the cost of renewables would fall. We are very concerned that that difference that is illustrated in that chart is something that renewable developers will be able to potentially raise their costs of their projects in such a way as to hopefully not, but potentially gouge ratepayers. We are extremely concerned about that, and we don't think that there are adequate protections. The 4% cap is simply not effective. We think that the other very important point for the committee to consider with this legislation is off-ramps. What I think we can all agree to today is that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we don't know what the future brings in terms of this technology, where we will be with regard to renewables. It is very important that there be an off-ramp and that the off-ramp be defined in this legislation to ensure that ratepayers are not harmed by this. Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, from your testimony, I would assume that you don't necessarily agree with Chairman Beyer's description that the Section 12 is the same as a rate cap or very similar. So I guess I just want to make sure that you're clear that you know, what I heard him say was it was virtually the same on the energy portion of the bill. And do you agree with that, what his assessment was? Were you here to hear it? I assume you've heard it.
Senator Beyer, I guess I respectfully disagree with Chairman Beyer. I have a lot of respect for him. I appear before him on a regular basis, so I want to say it very respectfully. We see it in a little different light.
And he's still in the room, by the way. He's right over there.
So, he's taking notes.
He's not looking at me. But the way that we see it, and we think this is a very important distinction, is that with a rate cap, that goes to the total cost that a ratepayer pays for the cost of his or her electricity. And with the cost cap, that is simply the difference between what is the hypothetical, say, combined cycle combustion turbine generating resource and the renewable. So it's that differential that this cost cap applies to. And if you look at my chart, you will see that that difference between that gap is huge. It's tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, that kind of rate impact would be devastating to business in the state. What we looked at, and it's also, we see the work paper attached to my written testimony, is that we calculated the effect of that 4% cost cap, and over the time period of 2010 to 2025, that for PGE and Pacific Core alone, that is $2.5 billion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Atkinson, quickly, please.
I have a couple questions for each, Greg and Julie. Quickly, Greg, you mentioned in one of your statements about a boiler that was reconditioned. How much did that cost that would not be able to be credited?
I don't have an answer for it. I can get back to you that on later.
And I think your colleague supported another statement you made, the cost cap will not work. I mean, it's her, you're in line with her. Julie, quickly, you made the point transmission matters, and that's a concept that I know there's a lot of talk, and we've heard you through a whole bunch of people talking for multiple days on testimony, but we really haven't got to some of the transmission load issues. Can you elaborate on that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I've never convinced myself in any case that I'm a transmission expert. What we continue to hear from folks in these same meetings that we've had for the last year on RP on renewables is that transmission does matter, primarily because when the wind blows, and I'm simplifying this, when the wind blows, wind power is very efficient. It's great. When it doesn't blow, it's not very efficient, and it only is 33% effective, or only blows 30% of the times that available. So, and then It's hard to know when it blows, so you don't know when you need to, quote-unquote, I'm simplifying this, pay the rent on the transmission lines. But I think the next person or one of the next people who is speaking from PNGC is probably going to be your best resource for that question.
Is the phrase false construct a market research ringledism?
No. Senator Avaki and Senator Atkinson, no. You know what? For not necessarily for the record, but I was going to talk about the IRP being a hypothesis that has AOI's hypothesis is that the integrated resource plan has worked. However, that hypothesis is being rejected. I cut that from my testimony, so I had you listen for the ringledism, and I apologize. Senator Atkins and I went to the same master's school. Got our master's from Atkinson. Sorry.
And you turned out so well, and look what happened here.
He was in the class behind me.
Can't blame the teacher.
Thank you, three of you. Next up, Dave Robertson with PGE, and Jason.
More than coming up like this. Go ahead and bring them up.
Sorry,
not so
Bates.
Bring them up. If you could supply me with the actual rates paid by your industrial customers in comparison to other states and other countries, I'd like to see those figures.
Okay. If you could put those through the committee chair, Sue Marshall. Dave Robertson and Jason Eisdorfer, while you two are coming up, let me do a little time check because the committee has other pressing business and we will lose our members shortly. And we will not be able to get through all the people that came today. Because there has not been much testimony in opposition until today, I wanted to make sure that we gave as much time to opponents of the bill today as we could. What we're going to do is we're going to do Mr. Robertson and Eisdorfer. We will then do Scott Bolton and Brent Gale from Pacific Power, and then Tom O'Connor, Jason Huser. That will take us to the end today. I apologize especially to Mr. Prescott, who came ready to do a presentation, but I think we're going to lose our committee members, and it wouldn't do it justice. So just see me afterwards, please. Okay, Mr. Robertson.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Robertson. I'm the Government Affairs Director for Portland General Electric. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. I'm here today to offer PG support for the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 838. This was a bill that started on about the 28th of February that came out as a Senator Avakian framework. We got together with a number of different parties, utilities, consumer groups, and environmentalists to try to work within that framework to make changes to the bill and make it more workable. And I guess what I'm here to tell you today is we were able to achieve a lot of changes in the bill that we feel provide a lot of flexibility in how the bill is implemented and give the PUC some authority to adjust as we go, that help control costs to our customers, that allow us to continue to plan for our resources within the integrated resources planning process that's in place right now, allow us to recover our costs in a timely way, and include just about all of the utilities across the state. Those were all things that we felt were real priorities as we looked at the RPS proposal over the interim and participated in a number of work groups. We think the draft accomplishes a lot of these things and addresses a lot of the priorities that we had listed before. We think there are probably a few things that we could work out as the draft moves forward and you work to try to pass it out of the committee, but they're relatively minor and I believe will be accepted in a consensus way. So happy to kind of cut it off there. I know you've got a lot of testimony to continue to hear.
That's
today.
Okay. I appreciate that. And before we move on, I did want to thank you. I know you put in an incredible amount of work in the last week in helping to get the bill to where it is, and not just you, but Peggy Fowler in particular, who was down at the Capitol and spoke with me about her support of the bill. And I hope you pass the committee's thanks on to her personally, too.
I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, attorney for the Citizens Utility Board. I testified before this committee on Senate Bill 373 last week, so I will be short. I'm really here to identify the cost cap and rate protection issues that we have worked into the bill and I think are quite robust. again, last week I talked about a different planning horizon between our members and perhaps some of the industrial customer members whose planning horizon is shorter term. I think they are concerned about shorter term rate increases. And on the flip side, I'm concerned about long-term rate increases. And if we don't take action now, I think that we, with the onset of carbon regulation, that we are really at risk of significant rate increases on down the road. The difference between acting now and adopting Senate Bill 838 and not acting is that here in this bill there are cost controls and there are off-ramps. The 4% cost cap that is in Senate Bill 838 is neither a guarantee of a 4% rate or cost increase, nor is it meaningless. If the differential between renewables and the market alternative is not significant or doesn't exist, in other words, if renewables are at market, no harm, no foul. It's also not meaningless over time as more resources are entered into the system. Potentially, if renewables are more expensive, it does provide a level of support. I look at Ms. Davidson's chart here, and I don't quite understand the point, because if we get renewables in at this incremental price, eyeballing it, it looks like a 0.5% over a 30-year period. I think we've all won. So the cost cap provision is meaningful. It is there. I'm actually going to let PacifiCorp talk about the alternative compliance payment in the next panel. I do want to make one quick reference to Section 13 of Senate Bill 838, which is the cost recovery provision. This allows this directs the PUC to identify a mechanism whereby the utility can recover some of the costs for renewables in a timely manner. It is limited to the timely recovery of prudently incurred investments in renewables. To do it such that a rate case is not needed every time renewables are brought onto the system. The cost provision is not pre-approval of a resource. This is timely recovery of prudently incurred resources, so there will be a prudence review of it. And it's also not a violation of Measure 9, which is codified as ORS 757-335, which states that only a resource that has come online and is currently serving customers can the utility recover costs for. So between those provisions, between the cost cap and the alternative compliance payment mechanism, we are quite confident that the consumer is protected from any market variances. And overall, the customer is most protected in the long term because the resource stack of utility is made much more diverse by this bill. Thank you.
And thanks to both of you. It's nice to see PGE and Citizens Utility Board at the same table together.
Take a picture.
And even submitting testimony together. Very nice. Thank you, both of you. Scott Bolton, Brent Gale.
One more group after this. Just stay for these two guys. Okay?
Yeah. All right. Chair Ivakian, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Bolton. I'm Government Affairs Manager for Pacific Power. Along with me today is Kyle Davis, our PacifiCorp Manager of Environmental Policy and Strategy, and Brent Gale, who is the Senior Vice President of Regulation and Legislative Affairs for Mid-American Energy Holdings Company, which Brent brings quite a bit of experience with regulation and experience with renewables from some of our affiliates. PacifiCorp supports the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 838. We fully support the goal of including cost-effective renewable energy to create a more balanced portfolio. And you can see that demonstrated in the aggressive renewable acquisition plan that MidAmerican has embarked upon with PacifiCorp since its acquisition of the company from Scottish Power 1 year ago this month. Within less than the first year of the new ownership, the company has acquired almost 400 new megawatts of cost-effective renewables, and we have a plan to increase that goal to another 1,000 to 1,500 megawatts very shortly. We looked at the renewable energy standard very hard, and we had a number of questions. We had a number of concerns about how this would impact our customers, what it would mean for costs, and what it would mean for workability to administer within our system. And we greatly appreciate all of the folks that we've worked with over the last well over a year through the Renewable Energy Working Group, and since we've began talking with different parties since the legislative session began. And really what I'd like to do in the interest of time for the committee is just highlight some of the improvements that we see in the Dash 2 amendments of Senate Bill 838. The first is assurance of reasonable costs. These amendments allow utilities more flexibility to comply with the standard and allow compliance alternatives when costs would be too high. The utility may generate the renewable energy necessary to comply with the target, or can acquire renewable energy certificates. And one of the key provisions is that we now have a much wider geographic area from which to acquire green tags or renewable energy certificates, which really helps, I think, address concerns about undue market power of developers in the region. Or we can opt to use an alternative compliance payment when that option is the most cost-effective for customers. And this is a particular mechanism that we're excited about because it does allow our regulators to have a look at where the prices are going, the availability of different tax incentives, and be able to help set another market signal besides the 4% cost cap that you've already heard quite a bit of testimony on. Another item, an improvement that we believe that the Dash 2s contain deals with planning. We have listened to our customers in this regard, in particular our larger industrial and commercial customers, who want a transparent and complementary resource planning process. We ask for, and these amendments contain, a tie-in to the existing integrated resource planning process and the implementation planning around our renewable acquisitions meeting our targets under the standard. This tie-in allows our regulators to look at investor-owned utility planning in a holistic fashion and allows customers and the general public significant opportunity to weigh in and provide their comment. We see this as a substantial improvement to the bill and one that should address the reasonable concerns that we've heard from our customers through this process. And we are happy that we'll be able to better align our implementation process for renewable acquisition with the existing IRP. And then finally, investment in new resources. These amendments incorporate other improvements to protect customers while not discouraging utility investment in renewable energy facilities. The amendments allow for recovery of utility investment at the time that the benefits flow through to customers. You've just heard Mr. Eisdorf discuss this. We think that this will still allow strong regulatory oversight over our investments while also promoting more optionality and more choices for the utility to go out and make the best resource decision at the lowest possible price for our customers. Again, Pacific Corp supports the goal of using renewable resources to the extent that we can to provide safe, reliable, and low-cost electricity to our customers, and we support the Dash 2 amendments. Happy to take any questions.
Well, why don't we finish up the panel here?
We're just here to take questions.
Oh. Okay.
At this point.
Good. Well, and I think we have none, so thank you to the three of you. And we are going to lose our committee right now, so if I could have Jeff Hammerlin and Tom O'Connor meet me up at the dais, please. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 838 and adjourn.